The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you find yourself getting mixed signals about the forthcoming election as far as Bible and Christian responsibility is concerned. Well, my friend, that's actually very understandable. If you're listening to this radio show for the first time, welcome. Allow me to reintroduce myself, because today I want us to walk a few steps back, take a deep breath, review some foundations, and do some reassessing. I am a Christian pastor, and I want to talk to fellow Christians right now. If you're not a Christian, if you are of another faith or even unreligious, atheist, agnostic, you're very welcome. And I hope you will continue to listen right now as well. I'm not suggesting that this conversation doesn't apply to you too. I just wanted to identify the group I am specifically speaking to, because I am about to make some very candid statements about our forthcoming election and our president up for re-election, a man whom, frankly, many evangelical Christians are having a problem with. Not myself. I like the man. I didn't always. He has grown on me, but I do like the man. Many other Christians I know like him as well, but today I'm talking to people who not only do not like Donald Trump, they can't stand Donald Trump. And because they detest him, they plan to vote against him despite his conservative policies, despite his stance for religious freedom, his stance against abortion, his stance for our Constitution, a literal reading of the Constitution, his appointment of justices who abide by the Constitution instead of legislating from the bench, his economic policies that have improved the lives of many, and you still won't vote for him because you just plain don't like him. He rubs you the wrong way. He does not behave like a Christian should. He does not, in your mind, behave like a decent human being at all. And he certainly does not behave like a president. He's not presidential. Are you relating? Am I talking specifically to you personally right now? You say that as a Christian, you cannot in good conscience vote for Donald Trump. I understand. You don't care for his personality. You don't care for his manners, his tweets. I get it. I sympathize. If those things bother you, you are probably a person of high conscience. I mean that. If you are a fellow evangelical Christian, you are not only a person of high conscience, but also a person who has confessed that you don't always live up to your conscience. You have confessed your sin. You have asked God to forgive you. You are a person who wants to follow Jesus as an example, a person who wants to be led by the Spirit of God, a person who wants Christ to hold even your thoughts and motives captive, constantly searching your heart, constantly purging your soul. As a Christian, you reject rudeness, you reject bad manners, you reject name-calling, and you should. Yes, I do understand. Having said that, please consider this, my friend. In any election, we need to look at both opponents, both sides. The first question, when we examine various platforms, which is more compatible with the standards God has put forth in the Bible? The second question, which candidate will protect those values? Now, notice I didn't say which candidate shares those values, but rather which candidate as a person in public office will protect those values. What are they promising to do? What are they not promising to do? What political party are they working with? Are the beliefs of their party consistent with the Bible? And when I say compatible with the Bible, I don't mean passing laws forcing people to become Christians. I'm talking about the standards, the religious freedom we have. For years now, we've been hearing that President Trump does not act presidential. While such assessments are common from his enemies, a recent survey found that this has been particularly unnerving to many of my fellow evangelical Christians when he insults his enemies or calls people names. Now, that bothered me back a lot, too, in 2016. Originally, Trump was not my first choice. I backed Ben Carson, later on Carly Fiorina, later on Ted Cruz as different people dropped out. I was backing a lot of people before Trump. But he did win the nomination, and when he finally won the nomination and ran against Hillary, I was very clear, some of you heard me in those days, I was very clear on my radio show, in my column, that I was no Trump groupie who would defend him right or wrong. No, I was not a Trump groupie. Instead, I called myself a Trump realist. I said something to this effect, and you can go back and listen to these shows or read these articles. I said, this guy is not a conservative, necessarily. Who knows what he really believes? This guy is a populist with a big mouth, and who knows what he really stands for? Who knows what he'll really do? He could do anything. He might be a great president. He might be a terrible president. He's a roll of the dice. But Hillary Clinton is not a roll of the dice, I said. There is not one thing she or her party stands for that is compatible with the faith of Christianity. Maybe in some democratic cases in the past, like the days of John F. Kennedy, maybe, but in that present year of 2016, they were not compatible with Christianity or the protection of our rights to freely share our beliefs or any standard at all found in the Bible. I said, I may not know where Trump will lead us, but I certainly know where Hillary will lead us. Given the choice, I would rather roll the dice, pray, and hope for the best. That is what I clearly said in 2016. Since then, I've got to tell you, I have been very pleasantly surprised. The man has kept his promises, and whatever he may or may not truly believe, the things he promised, the things he protects, are extremely consistent with Christianity. That, by the way, is an objective truth easily demonstrated by simply looking at the teachings of the Bible and the accomplishments of Trump, and also looking at the platform of the Democrats by comparison. But still, this may not matter to you. Once we get it in our heads that we don't like somebody, it's very difficult to change. Okay, so you don't like Trump, so maybe that'll never change. Well then, let's go at this another way. Let's go at this with another angle. Let's look at the other side. My dearest friends, please listen carefully. Kamala and others of their ilk calling Donald Trump a racist, none of them take that seriously, you should know. It's just a talking point to defeat him. They know it isn't true. Too many African Americans and Latinos are voting for Trump to make that sell. Too many people led by the Blexit movement are leaving the Democratic Party in swarms and running to Trump. Would they be voting for a man whom they thought hated them and was a racist and wanted to suppress them? Most of the Democrats and media elitists who call Trump a racist now never felt that way about him before he received the Republican nomination. They palled around with him, or at least had good relationships with him. He was in good rapport with Jesse Jackson. He was in good rapport with Al Sharpton. Charles Schumer happily accepted donations from him. Hillary Clinton invited him to her daughter's wedding. You see, calling people racist is simply the Democratic playbook fallback position for any major Republican candidate. They said the same about Bush. They called George Bush Hitler practically every day. Mild-mannered George Bush. They said the same thing about Romney. Romney's a racist. Granted, it's made easier by the brash manner in which Trump speaks. But look at his actions. His actions. And look at his policies. Ask yourself this. If I could ignore the man's personality, what exactly is it about his policies and accomplishments that I disagree with? And even more important, what is it about the policies of the alternative that you like? The Democratic Party not only accepts abortion, it accepts infanticide. Now, that is not the subject of tonight's program. I'm going to take a short detour with it right now because it illustrates a great point. There are many hideous things that the Democratic platform stands by, but I wanted to give you a little bit of detail with one of them. There's detail for others, too, that I'll go over in other shows, but it illustrates my point when considering the Bible and considering whether we as Christians will stand with the Bible or the latest politically correct trends that try to manipulate us. Now, we'd think Christians wouldn't need scripture to already know that taking of a human life in the womb is wrong. But for those who need scripture, The Bible does make it clear that an unborn child is already alive. Now, some of you listening right now once felt differently. Some of the women listening right now have had abortions and have since regretted it. I understand. God forgives you. I'm not here to make you feel bad. But at the moment, we are not discussing forgiveness for a violation of the standard. That is not what we're talking about today. We've had many radio shows where we have talked about that. But right now, we're not discussing forgiveness for a violation of the standard. We are looking at what the Bible says about the standard in the first place. In the Gospel of Luke, Mary, the mother of Jesus, after miraculously experiencing pregnancy, visits her aunt Elizabeth. Elizabeth is also with child. She's bearing John, who's later going to be called John the Baptist. I'm reading from Luke chapter 1. When Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the baby, notice they're calling this a baby, the baby leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit, and she cried out with a loud voice and said, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb." See, Luke is clearly describing John as alive, as a baby leaping in her womb. Luke goes on and tells us in the same chapter that Elizabeth had been pregnant for 6 months. This fact might be of interest for those who argue that abortion is only wrong during the third trimester. However, even for those who wish to distinguish between an unborn or already born child, this issue has gone light years beyond abortion and now involves infanticide as well. Not merely with late-term abortion where the baby is viable outside the womb, but regarding post-abortions. That's what they call them. Post-abortions of babies accidentally born in the process of late-term abortion. The Democrat platform is unrestricted abortion, unfortunately. Without restricting abortion, even in late terms, infanticide becomes easily justified. Now, you won't hear Democrats use the word infanticide. Our society is very good at changing titles to numb the effect of what's going on. Not long ago, America saw two hideous bills. One in New York passed into law only to be proudly affirmed. The other in Virginia did not pass. However, it was defended by Democratic Governor Ralph Northam. New York's Reproductive Health Act protects women's reproductive rights up to the birth of the child. The New York law says women can avail themselves of abortion services without fear of arrest, the only caveat being that the abortion must be necessary for the mother's health or that the fetus is not viable. Moreover, what is necessary for the health of the woman is not made clear. Furthermore, under the Reproductive Health Care Act, even non-doctors are able to perform abortions. Governor Andrew Cuomo justified this immoral decision for giving women, in his words, the fundamental right to control their own bodies. Now, that always sounds good. Choice, controlling our own bodies. But there's another human life involved. What about their choice? It always sounds good, the idea of people controlling their own bodies, but it begs a major question, and it avoids it with Orwellian newspeak. If the child is able to survive after birth and can simply be delivered instead of destroyed, what on earth does this have to do with the mother's own body? The claim is often made that the fetus is not viable as well. However, viability is not defined. Does the infant have Down syndrome? That's one of the questions that sometimes gets asked. Is a child with Down syndrome viable? I know people who have children with Down syndrome. They love their children. Well, those are the kinds of questions they're asking. Now, Virginia's House Bill, number 2491, was far worse. Fortunately, it failed, but it came close to passing. The proposed law would not have merely allowed the destruction of a fetus. It would allow the termination of life up to when the mother's cervix is dilating in preparation for delivery. Democratic Governor Ralph Northam described this. These are his words. He said, "It's done in cases where there may be severe deformities. There may be a fetus that's not viable. So in this particular example, if a mother's in labor, I can tell you exactly what would happen. The infant would be delivered. The infant would be kept comfortable. The infant would be resuscitated, if that's what the mother and family desired. And then a discussion would ensue between the physicians and the mother." He said this, ladies and gentlemen, defending the bill. He said it casually, in a matter-of-fact, friendly voice. It sent chills up my spine listening to him. It should send chills up your spine too. Thankfully, it did not pass, but a bill called the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act also didn't pass. That was a U.S. Senate bill which would have prevented future states from considering similar laws. It was brought up and defeated in the Senate. All but three Democrat senators voted against it. Kamala Harris voted against it. So did Bernie Sanders. This shows you where the party is. This is no longer the party of John Kennedy. It's more like the party they started out as, the party of slavery, Jim Crow laws, and the Ku Klux Klan. The Democrat Party back in those days began with a low regard for human life because only a low regard for human life could justify slavery. And they're returning to that heritage. What is the difference between calling a human being property in the context of slavery or calling a human being property in the context of deciding to kill a baby or not allow a baby to live after born in a botched up abortion? Again, my friends, we should not need scripture in order to see what most human beings, religious or otherwise, would view as abhorrent. But the Bible spans many years, including times when the life of a baby was not cherished in all cultures. This was particularly true of the Canaanite nations, which inhabited the promised land before God through Moses and Joshua brought the delivered Israelites in. Those nations were offering babies on the altar to their pagan gods. Prior to their entry, the law of Moses expressly said, using the name of one of their gods, I'm reading from Leviticus 18, do not give any of your children to be sacrificed to Molech, for you must not profane the name of your God. Now, I'm guessing that right now you're agreeing, biblically and morally, as a matter of conscience. At least many of you. Should be all of you. It's at least many of you, but you still can't stand Donald Trump's character, even though he signed the anti-abortion declaration with 30 other countries. He takes stands that obey Christ, but he doesn't, in your opinion, have the character of Christ. Frankly, my friends, I was quite conscious of the fact that in 2016, we did not vote Jesus Christ into office. We voted for a flawed man, as sinful as the rest of us. I make no assumptions one way or the other about whether Trump is a Christian. Neither do I care. Oh, yes, I care about his soul. I care about anybody's soul, but politically, I only care about policy and actions, not words and personality. In the Old Testament, neither King Cyrus, who released the Jews from Persia to return to their land and rebuild their temple, nor King Artaxerxes, who later released even more Jews to return to their land and rebuild the entire city of Jerusalem, neither of these were kings who accepted Yahweh as the one true God of the universe. God used them anyway. Be that as it may, let us not forget that Jesus himself called the corrupt leaders of his day vipers and whitewashed tombs. If Jesus visited today, speaking that way without revealing his identity, I guarantee you some Christian would rebuke Christ for not acting Christ-like. The whole notion of being presidential is vastly overrated. For one thing, the phrase is elusive. What exactly does it mean to be presidential? We've had men who acted very presidential, but policy-wise, they were horrible presidents. For many, being presidential is little more than an identification of which candidate smiled the most during a debate. Trump is not the first president to be scrutinized by such standards. In one of the debates with candidate John Kerry, President Bush was highly criticized for having a scowl look on his face. Never mind what he stood for, he had a scowl look on his face. That's the world of politics today. Enter Donald Trump, a man who talks without a filter, who often speaks first and thinks about what he said afterwards, thinks about a better way he could have phrased it afterwards. Is that unpresidential? Perhaps. But some find it refreshing to see a politician who shares his momentary train of thought for better or worse, warts and all. This stands in sharp contrast to politicians who will offer no comment about anything whatsoever without first consulting polls, focus groups, or personal advisors who caution their bosses to straddle the fence, making sure not to offend any of the special interest groups. But obviously, this is not refreshing to everybody. Many stand aghast at Trump's tone and controversial words. My friends, a tone is not as important as the truth. To ask ourselves the truth about which candidate to pick, we must look at what the Democrats have to offer. Before I go on, I know many Christians and other conservatives who voted for neither Trump nor Hillary, and in this election, they do not plan to vote for Trump. They will instead write in a candidate, somebody that they could really get behind. Now, if you're thinking of doing that, I know you mean well, but the fact is, and you already know this, the candidate you write in will not win. Writing his name may make you feel better, but that is the only thing it will accomplish. If you are a Christian, or another conservative, and you write in a name that is one conservative Christian vote that might have gone to the man who will protect conservative Christian values. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. I know you wish you had a different choice. You don't. I'll never forget the old Laurel and Hardy movie in which those two lovable buffoons were ordering dessert in a restaurant. They were asking the waiter what kind of ice cream he had. The waiter replied, "We have pistachio or vanilla." With gleeful, childlike enthusiasm, Stanley said, "I'll take chocolate." Life can be that way at times. Much as we'd like to believe we can have it all, much as we think we're entitled to unlimited choices, the list is not always as big as Ben and Jerry's. Sometimes we must choose between pistachio and vanilla. I sympathize with poor Stanley because those are not my two favorite flavors either. In fact, they are on the bottom of the list unless I beautify the vanilla with chocolate fudge, butterscotch, whipped cream, nuts, and a cherry on top. But they may not offer all that extra stuff. It might just be plain vanilla or pistachio. We can be in denial. We can assume, as Stanley did, that because we like chocolate, they must have chocolate. Indeed, we can be in so much denial that we do not even hear the waiter. But our strong opinions will not cause vanilla to morph into chocolate. Meanwhile, as we return to the choice before us now, a choice far more important than ice cream flavors, we must remember that abortion and infanticide are but two of many practices and policies and standards you must ask yourself about in weighing the questions for our next president. If you vote for the Democrats, you are voting with the socialists. And much as our universities are trying to make that a good-sounding word, when we look at countries with pure socialism, it sure doesn't turn out good. If you vote for the socialists, you are voting against our First Amendment freedoms of speech and religion. Why? Because pure socialists view those freedoms as threats to their agenda. They want, among other things, mandatory redistribution of wealth, and that does not go along with individual freedom and individual achievement, which is what our Constitution is all about. You are voting, if you vote for the socialists, for people who hate America, who want to rewrite its history. Now, we have a lot of problems in our history, but we have a lot of good things in our history, and they're not finding anything good about it at all. They want to, as the phrase has become popular, cancel culture, anything that does not pass their litmus test. Every statue, every movie, every television show, every book, including a book called the Bible. That's right. You will be voting for people who, if they get enough power, if they get their way, will outlaw the Bible. You are also voting for a party whose politicians looked the other way and told the police to stand down in the midst of riots, beatings, shootings, and the burning of buildings, and the death of innocent African-American lives who were targeted and lost in the name of a cause which claimed to be against racism. You are also voting for a party that wants your children indoctrinated, not just in college, that's been going on for years, but grade school and even kindergarten. They will tell your children that if they are white, they should feel horrible. They will tell your little boys that they may actually be little girls. They will tell little girls that they may actually be little boys. They will forbid the words male and female, father and mother. They're against the nuclear family. Now, I should say, there is sadly a good deal of compromise coming from evangelical pastors today. And so, as I talk about the Bible, I am painfully aware that some of you have pastors who don't take the Bible literally. Some of you listening right now are pastors who don't take the Bible literally. You find ways around controversial passages that are not woke or politically correct. Ironically, that creates another type of biblical problem. Look, I don't care for rude interruptions either. Neither do I care much for the tweets of the president. I appreciate that he wants to do an end run about the media that's going to try to take his words and explain to us what he said. I get that he wants to talk for himself. Some of them are better than others, but for the most part, I could do without his tweets, but let's get some perspective. My friends, make no mistake. If God allows us to lose our freedoms in this country, it will not be because of President Trump. The two most prominent reasons will be, first, people who in the name of Christianity or conservative values pat themselves on the back because their convictions would not allow them to vote for somebody who does not act presidential, all the while enabling a political party that stands for infanticide, anarchy, defunding the police, the end of the nuclear family, historical revision, suppression of religious freedom, suppression of other freedoms of the First Amendment and the Second Amendment, basically shredding the Constitution altogether once they feel the time is right, and communism in the name of the gentler sounding socialism. It has been said of late, you only vote for communism once, then you never make a free choice again for the rest of your life. The second reason God may allow judgment to our country, pastors who are especially accountable, pastors who compromise from the pulpit, whatever the compromise happens to be, from allowing the government to tell us how to meet or not to meet at all, to saying politically correct but biblically incorrect things about marriage, to accepting false historical narratives about our faith and so-called corporate generational guilt from people who would twist the scriptures to their own ends and intend to eventually outlaw the Bible anyway once they no longer have any remaining use for the compromising but compassionate pastor. Moral differences wider than the Grand Canyon divide our country right now. The Old Testament, in addition to focusing on God's special covenant with Israel, also talks about the judgment God will allow upon nations in general, often by withdrawing his restraining hand. In a nation such as ours, he fully understands that unregenerate people will continue to live sinful lives, what he expects from Christians. And even more specifically, Christian leaders is another story. This includes influencing those around us, encouraging the unsaved to turn to Jesus, the real Jesus, not another Baal with the title Jesus. This includes being the salt of the earth and the light of the world instead of taking our talking points from the philosophy of the world. Far more of our future depends upon the decisions of our evangelical so-called leaders than we may wish to think. I implore my fellow Christian leaders, wake up. After you have awakened, ask God for courage as you seek to get caught up. That is, caught up with taking some stands. Stands that may not win you any popularity contests, but stands that were once endowed to you with a sacred trust. I do not claim to be any special example myself. I simply claim that with God's help, all of us together can and must rise to the occasion. Acts 5, we must obey God rather than men. Okay, let's wrap this up. You say that you cannot in good conscience vote for Trump? I say that as a Christian with a conscience who knows what the Bible teaches, you need to get over it. God didn't give you a conscience to make you feel better. He gave you a conscience to help you take a stand during critical times when stands are needed. As a Christian with a conscience, you will someday stand before God. You will explain why you voted for infanticide, the shredding of our Constitution, the abolishment of the nuclear family, the rewriting of American history, people who demand that you give up your home in some cases because you're privileged, the elimination of your right to protect yourself by bearing arms should they come for your home because they're going to abolish the Second Amendment. And remember, if you think the police are going to come and protect you, the same people that say you don't need to defend yourself, we have the police, are also the ones defunding the police and telling the police to stand down. Meanwhile, there will be the suppression of free speech, fascist decrees of how or if we are allowed to meet as Christians, what we are allowed to teach about marriage, or eventually what we're allowed to teach about anything. In some cases, eventually outlawing the Bible itself as a book of hate speech. It's really a book of love and forgiveness. Doesn't matter. Those that don't like the Bible don't understand the Bible, probably haven't read the Bible, or they've read it out of context. They are calling it hate speech. They're going to be the ones making the policies. My friends, this is not a conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theories are guesses about what people are doing in back rooms smoking cigars and drinking rum. This is what the politicians are saying they're going to do, promising, bragging about, if not them personally, at least the special interest groups that they're catering to are claiming to do everything I've mentioned here. Everything. Look it up. Find their speeches online. Listen to them. They say if you listen to an evil person long enough, sooner or later, he'll tell you just exactly what he plans to do. And fighting against all of this, standing against all of this, defending our rights and freedoms, is Donald Trump. He has a 4-year track record of proving this, but he is rude and he tweets. I'm not saying you should like that. I'm saying put it in perspective. Consider the alternative. Think you don't like Trump? Well, you're not electing another Jesus Christ. There's only one Jesus Christ, a Jesus Christ whom you need to obey. He calls us to rise against the Democrat socialist wish list because this list is unbiblical. This list is evil. This list is hideous. And this is Bob Segal making the obvious obvious.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook or questions@bobsiegel.net. When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. We have a special guest with us today. Paul Looney is a board-certified psychiatrist, author, and pastor. He has worked with many individuals struggling with gender dysphoria and sexual identity. This is not merely clinical interest, but stems from empathy. Paul himself deeply desired to be a girl when he was young, and later found himself attracted to men rather than women. However, he has been married to his wife, Terry, for 41 years. They have 3 sons and 6 grandchildren. Paul, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I want to start by acknowledging your courage. I know that people who struggle with their sexuality but do not embrace the LGBTQ community receive all kinds of blowback and oppression. And frankly, on the other side, the church isn't always welcoming either, even when one has left the lifestyle. So on both counts, thank you for your honesty and your work.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, Bob, one of the big drivers of compulsive behavior is shame. And the way to experience freedom is by stepping into the light. And so, yeah, I think there's no other way to really be free and find your true identity than to step into the light and be honest about whatever struggles you might have.
I certainly agree with that. Now, in that vein, tell us what it was like feeling at a young age that you wanted to become a girl. For those who've never experienced that and are maybe trying to wrap their heads around it a little bit, could you tell us what kinds of thoughts entered your mind or what kinds of experiences may have accounted for such emotions?
Well, we don't understand fully the underpinnings of gender dysphoria. Part of it could be the context of the pregnancy, hormonal effects during pregnancy, could be partly just personality variables. You look at the twins, Jacob and Esau in the Bible, and Jacob is kind of a girly guy. He's smooth skinned, he cooks and hangs out with mom, while Esau is a manly man. He's hairy, he's hunter. And even though they're born at the same moment in history to the same parents, they have radically different ways of being in the world. And that was pretty much me and my brothers. I was the Jacob, they were more the Esaus. And so I think when you don't fit the mold of a stereotypical masculine or feminine role, there's that possibility of feeling that you don't belong in the body that you've got, that you identify more prominently with the characteristics of the other. And for me, a lot of it was just my interest. I was interested in art and I played with paper dolls. I, you know, shared a room with my sister, danced around the house in her nightgown. I think part of it might have been that my dad was more affectionate with my sister, and because I had a high need for affection, maybe that was part of what made me wish that I were a girl.
Yeah, you mentioned that, and you mentioned rejection from your older brother, too, in one of your videos I watched.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's very common with guys who struggle with same-sex attraction and may also be a factor in gender dysphoria.
Because they're not receiving the healthy masculine love, the brotherly love, the fatherly love, things like that.
Sure. Yeah. One prominent theory is that what's exotic becomes erotic, that if you feel disconnected from your own gender, then as you go through puberty, then you find yourself attracted to getting that same sex love that we all need, but in an unhealthy way.
Now, it's often assumed that one who turns from a gay lifestyle and becomes a Christian never struggles with those inclinations again. Maybe they've stopped the lifestyle or the actions, but a lot of people assume that they don't even feel the temptation. Some Christians think all we have to do is pray over somebody or lay hands on them, and their struggle just immediately goes away. But it's not always quite that simple, is it?
No. I oversee our recovery ministry, and you do occasionally see someone who is just radically delivered from, say, an addiction to opioids or whatever. They don't go through withdrawal. They're just completely healed and never struggle with desire again. But that's the exception. Most people continue to realize that that temptation is only a day away. And a lot of people just live their lives. I'm going to stay sober today because the struggle is always there. But the Apostle Paul gives us great hope because he learns through his own thorn in the flesh to actually find joy in infirmity and delight in weakness, because when we're weak, we're strong. I tell people it's my thorn in the flesh that keeps me close to the healer. And so for me, that struggle is still, I mean, it would be easy to turn that heat back up and engage in looking at improper images or desiring an improper connection. Just like many men have to deal with their sexuality, even though they choose a woman in marriage, doesn't mean they're never going to be tempted to look at another female figure.
Exactly. And once something goes into our mind, you don't just get rid of it easily.
Right. I know a few people who have experienced radical transformation where they seem completely switched over to a completely heterosexual mindset, but that hasn't been the case for me.
Right. Now, I once interviewed a person on this show who had turned from a gay lifestyle. He said something very interesting. He said a lot of people assume that the opposite of homosexuality is heterosexuality. But he says, for me, the opposite of homosexuality is holiness.
I love that. Yeah, I think that's very apropos. And it's what keeps me on the path. One of my favorite verses and an anchor for me in terms of my sexual struggles has been Psalm 63. It says, God, you're my God. My soul thirsts for thee. My flesh yearns for thee in a dry, weary land where there is no water. And so for me, just knowing that there's not anything on the planet that is going to ultimately satisfy my longing, it's really that my identity as the Son of God and the Bride of Christ that keeps me anchored. And I tell people, you know, if Bob Siegel tells me he's going to take me to my favorite steakhouse for dinner, I'm not going to stop on the way at McDonald's and get a burger. I'm going to wait for what's really going to satisfy. And that's, I think, our promise is if we embrace holiness, because he is holy, that he will, anytime I say no to immediate pleasure, he will promise me he'll make it up with eternal pleasures at his right hand. What that's going to look like, we don't know, but it'll be worth the wait.
So you said you grew up being attracted to men. I assume that even if that's still a struggle or a temptation, you now also find yourself attracted to women as well?
Yeah. What I tell guys who struggle, I say, look, you don't have to be attracted to every woman on the planet. You just have to be attracted to one. And, you know, when Jacob left home at 40, his brother already had two wives. Jacob is still single. And then sometime after that, then he meets Rachel and just like there's a match.
There's a guy that didn't want the second woman. She was kind of thrown at him.
Exactly. But God gave him the grace to have father 12 sons with four different women. But he was probably a guy who really struggled with his own sense of masculinity. And I sort of think that his wrestling with God really was where he finally came to terms with his identity and who he was and got that blessing of the new name, that he finally held on to God until he could really encounter his weakness and his strength simultaneously.
Now, there were a lot of legal battles for years when they were trying to pass same-sex marriage. And what we kept hearing is that people are born a certain way. And it sounds like to some degree you agree with that, but I'm also hearing you talk about some psychological factors. I do find it interesting that now that we've reached this point where it's the whole LGBTQ spectrum, we're being told that people can just choose to identify with. Doesn't that throw the original argument out the window?
That's a very good observation. I think you're exactly right. The thing that we know is that sissy boys are more likely to struggle with their gender identity or their same-sex attraction because, again, they're not completely grounded in their masculinity. And thankfully, what my parents did was they didn't shame me for my interests that were rather girly, but they also didn't endorse it. And it turns out that if you don't socially transition kids, kids, then they'll naturally, between 61 and 98% of them, will naturally leave that desire to be opposite gender behind.
Well, yeah, and people are going into schools now, and I think are planting ideas in kids' heads who aren't even thinking that way.
Yeah, it's horrifying. Yeah, anytime, whenever you lower the threshold for a way for people to feel that they can control their own suffering, whether it's suicide or cutting or gender reassignment, when you lower that threshold, people are going to jump that fence much more readily. And that's part of what disturbs me about our environment now. So much rise in anxiety, in depression and suicide. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we don't encourage people to face their fears and to do the hard things. We want to make it easy for them to feel better immediately, but that robs us of the formation of character that we all need. Just briefly back to your question about nature versus nurture, there are a lot of different factors that go into same-sex attraction. But for me, the real question we need to ask goes back to what your other guest said about holiness, is that the pot really can't say to the potter, why have you made me this? We have to wrestle with the way we're made and believe that God made us uniquely to express His purpose for us. Ephesians 2, you know, I think it's verse 10. We are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which He prepared in advance that we should walk in them. And I firmly believe that one of the big transitions for me was to realize that I needed to trust God with the way that He made me. And that if I had something of a girly brain, He could use that to His advantage if I surrender to Him and choose to live in that tension between what my flesh might want and what He has for me. And the tension, to me, is something that our culture is not good at managing tension. We want to be certain about things. We want to be right about what we believe or our stance. And I think sometimes that creates a tendency for people to want to solve problems too quickly rather than just being in that waiting on God time that can be so challenging.
Yeah, it has seemed to me that the jury is still out on this. I know that people talk about the APA back in 1973 declassifying homosexuality as an emotional disorder, but we also have some people who were there, such as psychiatrist Charles Socorides, who said he had treated gay people for years.
Oh, yeah.
And had seen recovery. For sure. He said that there was so much political pressure, far more than scholarly debate. In fact, people felt pressured. They voted by secret ballot. Two-thirds of the ballots weren't even turned in. A slim majority of the one-third that was turned in. So we hear that. But on the other hand, I'm perfectly willing to consider that there might be two kinds of gender dysphoria or homosexuality, a kind that we are born with and another kind that is a learned behavior. And it seems to me that if somebody isn't sure which one it is, we should not be preventing them from going to a counselor or psychologist or psychiatrist and trying to explore those other possibilities. Even Dean Hamner, who did one of the clinical studies that came out with biological, physiological inclinations, said we're not here to negate psychosocial factors. Even he admitted that could be part of it as well. Would you like to speak to that a little bit?
Sure. Well, what I believe, Bob, is that something like bipolar disorder or someone who has a hot temper, there may be biological underpinnings for that, just like alcoholism. But our responsibility is to shepherd our souls well in the face of whatever our natural bent is. Some guy may struggle with lust mightily. He may be biologically predisposed to be hypersexual. Does that give him a license to be promiscuous? No, it doesn't. Somebody has a biological underpinnings for alcoholism or bipolar disorder. They have to manage that in a way that honors God. Even if we were to find a gay gene, which there is not one, and I don't think we'll ever discover one, but even if there were, it doesn't take us out of the realm of personal responsibility for being able to honor God. If someone is, say, have a woman who's born very homely because her genes just weren't very good in the looks department, that may consign her to very limited options for marriage, but that doesn't give her license to find her sexuality in a different realm. We have to be willing to trust God and say, okay, God, I don't get this. I don't like this, but I love you. I know that what you ask of me is right.
Right. And as you were saying, in the case of somebody, I know there's debate on this too, but it's believed by many that you can be born an alcoholic, but we wouldn't encourage an alcoholic to go into a bar.
Exactly. Exactly.
And when you think of it, the Bible says all of us are born with a sinful nature. We're sinners by choice also, but we also have a nature that's inclined to sin. God does not accept that as an excuse when we have the ability to turn to Jesus Christ and the power of the Holy Spirit.
I totally agree.
Now, you mentioned something very interesting before. You said that you feel your mixture of masculinity and femininity may be a gift and give you a certain kind of empathy as a therapist. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Sure. As a psychiatrist, I work with couples a lot. I do workshops for couples, and I supervise our almost 70 lay counselors. And so my ability to identify with the feminine gender as well as the masculine gender really makes it easy for me to have empathy. And in working with couples in particular, I feel like I sometimes function as a translator to help a man be able to hear his wife's heart and for her to understand his rather more limited vocabulary.
Well, you know, when you think about it, Jesus was the perfect mediator, because he was both God and man. I don't want to stretch the illustration too far. But a good mediator has got to be able to relate to both people.
Sure. Well, you know, all of us have sort of a blend of masculine and feminine qualities. And really, what I see in my work with couples is that when you have a G.I. Joe Barbie couple, where you have a hyper-masculine guy married to a hyper-feminine woman, it can be really hot in the bedroom, but they have less opportunities for friendship because she wants to get her nails done, he wants to watch sports. Whereas if you have a couple that both enjoy some of the things that are not stereotypically masculine or feminine, have much better opportunities for friendship and companionship and cooperation. So I think that we make a mistake to think that we all should be G.I. Joe or Barbie. We actually may all do better to be somewhere in the middle of the spectrum. But like you said, I have found that in spite of my self-rejection early in my life, once I said, okay, God, well, you must know what you're doing. You made me to do your will. And I think that Ephesians verse really indicates that God prepared in advance the things that he wanted us to walk in. And so that means that Bob Siegel is the perfect man to do what God has for Bob Siegel to do. You have everything you need to be that guy. And same with me and the people I work with. We are each one designed specifically to carry out a function for which we are the perfect person.
Yeah, all things work together for good to those who love God. And by saying all things, that means even things that we don't think are working too well.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, Bob, you know, I grew up in the Church of Christ, which is pretty legalistic and pretty black and white. And I so desperately wanted to be in the Lord's army and to make God proud. And I was kind of had the Apostle Paul mentality, like I want to be a Hebrew of the Hebrews and do it all right. And for me, coming to terms with when I really became aware of my same-sex attraction, it busted the bubble and made me realize just how desperately I needed God. You know, my quest to be the perfect servant of God really just came crashing down and saved me, I think, from a lot of self-righteousness.
I know that in some places, a psychiatrist can lose his license for doing conversion therapy. Do you know how many states have laws to that effect? And is it affecting your outreach where you are?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. I know there are people who have suffered loss of privileges at hospitals or clinics and loss of license. I don't know the statistics on that at all. And Texas is, of course, much more conservative, and partly because I have a private practice and I see largely people who claim faith in Jesus. I haven't experienced that. And I've had the privilege of working with people who aren't Christians as well, who really want somebody to speak truth to them. And when I work with a young man or a young woman who's having gender dysphoria or dealing with same-sex attraction, a lot of my goal is to ask them to be curious about what that's about and not act on it. Because, again, if you can just keep people growing in their awareness of who they are and who God is, a lot of them will find a satisfactory resolution and find, like I did, that even if you're not attracted to every person of the opposite sex, God will bring someone to you that can be a suitable helper or suitable partner. Not everyone, of course, is going to get married, but for a lot of us, it really provides a great opportunity to learn to love someone who's uniquely different and sometimes radically different than we are.
Right. Now, many evangelical Christians, sadly, are now embracing the whole LGBTQ agenda. Can you comment on how some are getting around very clear Bible passages?
Well, it's tragic to me. I think that people don't understand that you can be compassionate and hang out with those people like Jesus did, the sinners of his day, without endorsing their conduct.
Yeah, like Jesus with the woman that was caught in adultery. He loved her. Yeah. He was merciful, but he still said, go and sin no more.
Exactly. And I think that's where this polarization that we have, we kind of think all or nothing. And I think that when I work with a family who's grieving that they have a child who is embracing homosexuality or transitioning, my belief is that they need to find a way to be clear about their convictions and what they believe God wants for their child without rejecting the person. And I think it's hard to do, but I think that Jesus did it beautifully, and I think he can empower us to as well.
Okay, Paul Looney, certified psychiatrist, yes, author, and pastor. What an honor to meet you, sir. I hope you'll come back and join us again sometime.
Oh, I'd love to. Thanks, Bob. Hope you have a wonderful evening, and I'll be praying for a good result on Tuesday.
Yeah, me too. So say we all.
Alrighty. Thank you.
We'll see you, everybody.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the law offices of Matthew Simone.